Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today we're speaking with Catherine Schultz, the Dean of the School of Education at the University of Colorado Boulder, about her new book, Distrust and Educational Change, Overcoming Barriers to Just and Lasting Reform. In her book, Dean Schultz provides powerful examples of how distrust and the failure to acknowledge and address it can derail any attempt to engender meaningful and lasting change in public schools. Dean Schultz, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
So I'd like to start with a conversation about what inspired you to write this book. As I read through it, I felt very much like I was reading a reflection on your own policymaking career. That is, when we're taught as a society to never admit failure or never be wrong, and so much policy research can often reflect this by offering solutions in a prescriptive tone, you're very honest and vulnerable about how distrust challenged and sometimes derailed your own attempts to generate meaningful and lasting change. So what inspired you to examine distrust, and what audiences do you hope to reach with this book?
That's a great question. It is very much a reflection on my career working to make change. As a professor and then as a dean, it's been very important to me to not only write about what I know, but to be engaged in change, to be engaged in the actual work of using what I know about education to make things better, to provide more opportunities for youth. And so this book is very much a reflection of some powerful experiences that I've had and some lessons that I've learned. In particular, we're living in a time when there's a lot of distrust. And so I felt that the stories that I had and the experiences I had as well really were revolving around distrust.
So you focus on education policy, but how, in your view, does distrust in public education reflect a broader distrust of public institutions?
It absolutely does reflect the moment that we're in, and distrust that sort of most obviously people are feeling in the political system and the very sort of partisan nature of, you know, sort of national politics as well as politics in some places at the state and local levels as well. I think that there's a real dis-ease about people. And you did ask why I, my intended audience, and I think that speaks to it, that I really do hope that the audience from this book is not only academics and scholars, but really people who care about making change, and in particular, who care about making educational change.
You offer several case studies that highlight the specific ways in which distrust can undermine public education policy. For example, in one case, you walk through a decade plus worth of reform in Oakland, California. How did the example of educational change in Oakland help you understand what you call relational distrust?
So I've had the privilege of working in Oakland two different times in my career. I worked there in the early 90s when I was a postdoc at UC Berkeley. And then I was there as a dean more recently, several decades later. Oakland has an incredible history and is just a very, it's a community that has many people who care deeply about education, and incredible teachers, incredible schools. And at the same time, it has a history of just being a failing district. And so I was very interested to understand why it had this history of being a failing district and where that came from. The idea of relational trust is something that Tony Bryke and other people had written about. And so I was interested in sort of thinking about, well, what did that mean if you framed it as distrust? And the sort of decades of attempts at reform in Oakland really seem to reflect just this relational distrust, the sort of tensions that were felt among the various communities, sort of racial tensions, as well as, of course, across tensions across class line. The Bay Area is known for the sort of the flats and the hills where there's big disparities in terms of wealth. And the idea of how so many of these changes that were attempted by well-meaning superintendents were just stopped in their tracks because the superintendents themselves couldn't get past a past the distrust. And so it seemed to me to be a good example of sort of many well-meaning superintendents who had ideas that many of us respect and even funding from a number of sources, and still were met with failure.
A lot of your research has examined the role of listening in various educational settings. How has this work and your experiences in Chester, Pennsylvania and Lebanon helped you to identify two additional forms of deep-rooted distrust, which you call structural distrust and contextual distrust?
Well, I think it's great that you noticed that listening was a powerful theme. Those two experiences, my experience as a board member in Chester and then as somebody who did professional development with Palestinian principals and teachers in Lebanon, pointed out to me different kinds of distrust and helped me develop this framework that I have for thinking about distrust. In Chester, I had the opportunity to be on an elected school board for a number of years. Chester is a very interesting community. It's predominantly African-American and Republican, which probably doesn't exist in too many places. At the same time, it's one of the poorest districts in Pennsylvania, in the state, and one of the lowest performing districts, which is why it had an elected board. The previous board had been a Republican board, and we were elected by the governor to come in and try to reverse some of the changes that they had made. One of the things that the Republican board had allowed was for over half of the students in Chester to attend charter schools, and in particular, most of them attended two schools run by the same individual that were for-profit schools. As a board, we didn't start off being against charter schools, but what we were most concerned about is that the fact of charter schools was basically strangling the district. And so there wasn't enough money simply for the district run public schools to run. So we had a lot of work cut out for us from the very beginning. And we were all full-time employees. It was two African-American men and myself. And one was a lawyer, one worked for the state education system, and I was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And so we really tried hard to turn around the system that was struggling, working with the governor's office and working with local people in the district. One of the things I learned from our work together, though, was that while our intentions were to work very closely with the elected board, because we knew ultimately they would take over the district and we wanted them to, we didn't spend enough time doing that. And so that's the kind of structural distrust that I talk about. It would have been easy to say, well, these people didn't trust us. There was relational distrust, and that's why things didn't work out well. But what I use this chapter to talk about is the real political systems and historical distrust that was in the district that we didn't really address. So we tried to build strong relationships. In particular, I worked with community members, but we didn't really address the many, many years of historical and structural distrust that was there. And as a result, when we left about 3 years later, we had made enormous changes. And within a year, all of those changes unraveled. So the new schools that we had started were closed down again. The teachers we were able to hire because we saw some contract disagreements were let go again. The libraries are closed. All these different things that we had done to really make substantive changes the district could no longer afford them. And, you know, what remained sort of ironically were the new playgrounds and those kind of structural things. So that was a real lesson in the sort of importance of not only coming in and quickly making change, which though it wasn't that quick that we were doing it, and that it wasn't enough to try to build relationships with people, but that there were some structural things that we needed to address. The example in Lebanon illustrates to me a different kind of distrust. We did work with Palestinian principals who were running schools that are basically in isolated camps in Lebanon, and I won't go into detail because it's quite a complicated story. But I did, you know, I did the kinds of professional development that I had done in my work in the United States with two colleagues, Theo Abelhaj and Judy Buchanan. And and even though we were sort of working at the beginning of our professional development, again, to build trust, we had people writing poetry. We had them really sort of talking about themselves and building relationships. In the end, what sort of was overriding was the what I call contextual distrust, or the distrust between the different factions of the Palestinian groups, that again overrode the kind of surface, more relational trust that we had attempted to build. So again, it really taught me about the importance of looking deeply into exploring what the distrust is before sort of moving forward, trying to make change.
I think another theme that works itself throughout your book is the way you describe different educational stakeholders. You work really hard to think about the motivation of each of the groups involved, and you often describe in detail how each of these groups is often well-meaning and working hard to help kids, but we can often talk past each other because of the distrust that has built up over time. You talk about the role precarity plays in creating distrust among groups. What do you mean by precarity? And how does it add to the complexity of educational policymaking when a few outside reformers attempt to, quote unquote, fix schools with quick fixes?
Well, so I borrow the term from anthropologists of precarity, which really just is another way of talking about the unstable times, sort of filled with insecurity, that we're living in. And, you know, I think many of us, or most of us, are aware of these unstable times. We're aware of it in particular at certain moments when we learn about the conditions of immigrants at our border, when we think globally in terms of the conflicts that are happening and continuing to happen around the globe. The current precarity in Syria is an area that I'm really concerned about and think about a lot. And that same kind of precarity pervades all of our lives, I think, now. And what people want to sort of get out of that feeling, they want to feel better, they want things to be fixed. And what happens too often, I believe, is that we turn to quick fixes. I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of medicine and psychiatry and sort of the inclination to take a pill rather than to really dig deeply into what the problem is. And that certainly has happened a lot in education, where we've turned to a solution. And what happens too often is that solution is a Band-Aid, not surprisingly. But it's also the fact that it tends to rest on sort of solving a problem at the surface level, which again, as I've sort of been saying again and again, without going to the deeper level. The even more important problem with that kind of solution is that it tends to rest on blame. And, you know, I think a lot of people have talked about this, that in education, we tend to have sort of circuits of blame. So we blame students, we blame students for being lazy and not trying hard enough, or being recalcitrant or resistant. Other kinds of theories blame teachers for being lazy or uneducated or not really up to the challenges of teaching. Alternatively, we blame schools, and public schools are blamed, and we see that with this sort of growth of alternatives to public schools, namely vouchers and charter schools. And then finally, we blame teacher education programs and again, for not preparing teachers well enough. So those two are very closely connected, of course. And the sort of rise of alternative routes to teaching, and the circuits of complaints about teacher education. But too often, again, the quick fixes sort of might solve things at the surface level, but the problems will pop up again if we don't really look deeply into where the real challenges are and propose solutions that address those.
I think because of the recent visibility of public debates about schools, we can begin to believe that distrust has only recently become a problem in public schools. But you walk the reader through a history of educational change that is actually rooted in quick fixes and deficit perspectives. How has education policy progressed in a way that has built upon decades worth of distrust?
Well, as I sort of thought about these examples, I decided that it was really important to locate them, as you say, in sort of the history of educational policy to show that it's not just what we're doing now because we're a quick society, but actually one, you know, sort of endemic problem about educational change is that they have been, that one way to understand them, one framework for understanding educational policy and the failure of most educational policies is to see it through distrust. And so I just pick a couple sort of key moments in U.S. history to illustrate how this framework of distrust can help us understand what's wrong with how we're approaching educational policy or educational change, and perhaps suggest some solutions. So the first people talk a lot about Brown v. Board of Education as sort of the first sort of moment of, or large moment of educational policy. And I talk about how, while that case, of course, was instrumental in pointing out the inequality of opportunity for all children and youth in the United States, it essentially, the solutions that came from Brown v. Board of Education were based on blaming students and families. And so what happened as a result of Brown v. Board of Education in most cases is that schools, of course, were integrated, though not for long, as we know. But also the push was to basically teach African-American families white middle-class values. And so the solution was really based on a deficit perspective of Black children, Black youth, and their families and communities, rather than building on the strengths and of Black teachers, but also those family, the Black families and the students themselves. So that's sort of one kind of clear example, and sort of the compensatory practices of the Johnson administration. Just even the word, you know, compensatory practices really sort of tells you that what's happening is that people, the policies were trying to bring students who are living in poverty, students of color primarily, up to the standards of the white middle class norm, rather than again valuing the assets that communities brought to their schools, and also, of course, teachers brought to the schools. The second example I bring is also another sort of key moment in U.S. educational history and policy is A Nation at Risk. And, you know, A Nation at Risk, of course, you know, sort of pointed out to the, you know, in sort of this very kind of flowery language, militaristic language actually is more accurate, that that we as a country, the United States as a country, was facing mediocrity. And of course, who was blamed for this mediocrity were the teachers. So really what this report does is blame teachers, somewhat teacher education, but really focuses on teachers. And what came from A Nation at Risk was the standards movement. So instead of trusting teachers to understand the content and providing them with professional development so that they would teach really well, what came from this sort of report with this sort of histrionic language about the mediocrity of our school system were a system of standards that prescribed how teachers would teach, and also high stakes testing that again distrusted teachers to know how their students were doing. So that again, the solutions, there may have been a problem. There's a lot of controversy about that, but the solutions were based on blame and distrust, circuits of blame and distrust, as I call it.
So far, we've spent a lot of time on the challenges that can be brought about by distrust, but you do offer hope. For example, you emphasize the importance of time, but juxtapose this with the emphasis of corporate reformers on this idea of disruption. You highlight the differences, for example, between the approach taken up by the cities of Newark and Union City, New Jersey. For listeners who may not know, reform in Newark was predominantly funded by a venture philanthropist, Mark Zuckerberg, whose company, Facebook, had the motto, "Move fast and break things." What do the different approaches to reform tell us about how local communities can begin to approach change in meaningful and significant ways?
Well, we all sort of were reading about Newark when Cory Booker brought together Facebook and Gates and sort of poured money into Newark to make changes. And, you know, that was sort of a case that a lot of people followed. It was very interesting to read about Union City that was just miles away that took a very different approach. So to briefly summarize my sort of understanding of what happened in Newark, and again, this is my framework of distrust, was that a lot of money was brought to Newark and a lot of outside consultants who were very well paid, and ideas were imposed on the district without really enough discussion in the grassroots of the district. So the so charter schools were brought in, new sort of ideas were funded. Again, high paid consultants were brought in. But what failed to happen in Newark was really sort of listening to the solutions that might have been generated from the ground up or from the grassroots. And as a result, there pretty much you could say that none of the reforms stuck. It's a much more complicated story that a lot of people have told, but there was the way that the reform was handled generated just huge amounts of distrust from local people who've been working in Newark for years to try to reform the school system. In contrast, just again, you know, down the road, not very far away, is Union City, New Jersey. And there, both cities were cities that were sort of at risk and at times had been taken over by the state. So both cities, in both cities also had sort of high levels of poverty and big challenges. What happened in Union City, though, in contrast to Newark, is that teachers were led the reform. So the reform was slower, and it was supported by many different people at a local level. The mayor supported it, the superintendent supported it, but they really put their trust this time in teachers to generate solutions. And so there are a number of solutions generated by teachers that included really thinking hard about how emergent bilingual students were being taught and sort of bringing professional development to schools so that they're not the teachers' knowledge of how to address the challenges students brought to their classrooms, especially as non-native speakers, could be addressed and could be addressed from an asset lens of really thinking hard about how to build classrooms around the strengths and assets of the students. The same kind of reform has been described in Union City in terms of early childhood learning. And so again, rather than thinking in a compensatory way of how do we catch these children up, there's a real way of understanding the strengths and the assets of the community and building on those to re-envision reform.
So you also provide a powerful framework that facilitates building trust in schools and in classrooms. How can we begin to work together to build trust? And are there policies and approaches to educational change that have resulted in meaningful change in the lives of teachers, parents, students, and communities?
Well, I think it was very important to me to conclude the book with some examples of hope and possibility. I'm a strong believer that you have to do more than point out what's wrong, but it's also important to think about what does work. I've been lucky enough to work with a group called the Philadelphia Teachers Learning Cooperative for many years. I was part of this group when I was first a teacher. And it's a group that's been inspired by Patricia Carini, who founded a school called the Prospect School in North Bennington, Vermont. But what's amazing about this teacher group that continues to meet in Philadelphia once a week is it it has developed a set of processes that really looks at the strengths that children and youth bring to their education and to schooling, and using knowledge of children as doers and makers and with enormous capacities to think about, to really re-envision and understand teaching and learning. I also point out a number of other examples, which I'll just sort of talk about quickly. One is community schools, and we all have talked a lot about community schools and the power of community schools. I was fortunate enough to spend some time with teachers and the principals and the social workers in Oakland, in the Oakland International High School. This is an incredible school, and I was there at a time in Oakland when there were a recent influx of unaccompanied minors. And I was able to see the community approach that this school took to really provide, again, to seeing the incredible resources that these youth brought in terms of their language, but also in terms of their knowledge and their the strength that they had in making the journey and being dedicated to learning. I could really sort of understand the promise and possibility of community schools. A lot of people think about, well, the answer to distrust is to build trust. And while that's absolutely true, it's important to build trust, I think it's also true that it's important to acknowledge and to really explore the distrust. And so in these schools, through these processes I was describing, in community schools, you know, in particular the one I just talked about in this after-school program, the leaders, the teachers, didn't simply say to the children, okay, now we're going to all trust each other, we're going to build community, and we're going to all really believe in each other, and things will be okay. Instead, they really gave the students their time, and they didn't force anybody to tell stories, but they gave them spaces to talk about, to build and create, to represent through art the distress that they had experienced. And it was only by really exposing and really examining the distrust were they able to move forward. And I think that's a very important message of my book. I think too often what happens is we go on to the next idea without really sort of exploring what happened before. And just to return to the Oakland example of relational distrust, you know, one of the points I really make about relational distrust is too often we identify the relational distrust without really understanding the structural or the contextual reasons for the distrust. So it's easy to understand with superintendents. A new superintendent comes in and wants to try a new idea without really examining why the old ideas didn't work. And I argue strongly that it's important to really closely examine the distrust, you know, which in part is why I wrote the book, is to give narratives, to give really deep and detailed examples of what that distrust looks like.
Thank you, Dean Schultz, for sharing your powerful work examining the role of distrust in public schools. I think even though you focus on the role distrust plays in educational change, that it's evident that this work is a valuable resource for anyone exploring the broader role distrust plays in our society and within our individual interaction with our democracy and public institutions. Next month, we'll be speaking with Kevin Kumashiro, the former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco, about the Education Deans for Justice and Equity Alliance. Education Deans for Justice and Equity is a nationwide alliance of education deans that advances equity and justice in education by speaking and acting collectively and in solidarity with communities regarding policies, reform proposals, and public debates. As always, thanks for listening, and remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu, and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.